This is HPR episode 2840 entitled HPR NYE Show 2018-2019 Part 3. It is hosted by Honky Magu and is about 122 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is, the HPR community comes together to say Happy New Year and chat.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
How are we all this fine New Year's Eve?
Still New Year's morning.
See, I'm from the future. I'm a time traveler. Yeah. I'm actually in the future.
Oh, we're doing pretty good. We have had a couple of interesting conversations on various topics.
But no one's talked about trombones, in case you were thinking about talking about that today.
That sounds like a writing prompt. Or a euphemism.
It wasn't meant to be. I just kind of pulled it out of the air.
Yeah, well, that's what you tend to do at the other end of the trombone. That's how you play it.
I don't know if we've talked about gaming yet.
Well, funnily enough, that was the whole reason why I'm actually on iOS, sorry, is I decided rather than what I usually did with the HPR New Year thing was just sit at the computer and chat and wasn't really doing anything in the background. But this time I figured, you know what, I'm going to sit and I'm going to do the obligatory gaming drunk driving thing with Forza Horizon while I'm chatting. So I'm not doing push to talk unless it gets annoying, unless people request that I move on to push to talk. Then yeah, so at least that way it's something to do rather than just sit and chatting. But in terms of gaming, why is that jerky? Yeah, and in terms of gaming, what do you think? See, with I've been kind of wondering about how badly Battlefield 5 and Fallout 76 have kind of backfired, and it almost feels like they've pushed it too far. Basically, Bethesda and EA have pushed it too far, where they're trying to cut costs, but they've just cut it too much that the product they've put out at the end is noticeably poorer for the people that would have bought it, and they're not buying it. They've just pushed the limits too far, basically. And the end result is both of them have went on sale immediately. Both of them have been deemed pretty much flops.
No, I haven't played any of the Fallout games, so I'm not sure. Most recently for me, it's been Watch Dogs and, I continue playing Borderlands 2 while I wait impatiently for Borderlands 3.
Was it PC or console or...?
PC.
I don't know. I've maybe just got kind of an outdated idea of gaming on a PC, but I think of a PC as something that the games just keep pushing the envelope, and you don't know what kind of quality you're getting out of the game, because you know every piece of hardware is different, and every combination of hardware is different, and it's just, I remember like years ago it used to be watching other people having to mess around with drivers and rebooting this and move this file from here to there, and I think that's probably a thing of the past. To be fair, but
yeah, there's still some of that going on, especially if you're doing gaming on Linux.
Yeah,
which I am.
There is
Borderlands. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's the Xbox One, the PS4 that I'm a game on, but the more I've looked at it, the more I've been getting kind of interested in like simulator games. ones where you essentially, I mean, it's cool. It sounds sad, but simulating a job. And there seems to be an awful lot more variety on Steam of that type of thing.
Cool.
Yeah, as bizarre as it sounds, the idea of sitting, doing a farming simulator where you spend 30 seconds driving in a straight line, sort of bum, 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 as you like, plow the field and turn at the top and come back down again and turn at the bottom. You know, just that kind of thing. And sort of once you've got the field ploughed, then you go and change the attachment and go to another field and do something else. And
yeah, I seem to remember that game. And if I remember right, it was in really good HD, or maybe no, I actually did that.
Yeah, I mean, there is quite a few games like that where the simulator, they take it to the nth kind of degree of doing that job, and farming was just one example. Seen like the police simulator, there's a thief simulator, there's a there's an airport simulator, there's a American truck driver or Euro truck simulator kind of thing, driving articulated trucks various places. As bizarre as it is, I can sort of see the appeal in them, just as a kind of passing the time, just sort of chilling, admiring the scenery.
Do they actually, like, use real environments?
As in real locations around the globe.
Yeah. Like real pictures or simulated realness of what things actually look like.
As far as I'm aware, yes. I think there are limited places in the map. These are things that I've been looking at. I've not actually tried any of them yet. I've just been starting to explore them, and as I said, I don't play on a PC, and a lot of these are unfortunately Steam only at this point, which I'm not aware I can run either on an Xbox or a PlayStation. But as far as I understand, yes, it's the videos I've seen are specific routes between like German cities or whatever, or between American cities, or I don't know. It might be more like the crew, where it's made to look very close to it, but it's not a one-to-one recreation of the map. It's kind of contracted a bit. It might be that. I'm not sure. I don't know any of the areas enough to actually be able to tell that.
Okay. Would you prefer console gaming?
Well, I like the idea of just pick up and play, which that could be the case now with PC gaming. It's just for me, I've always associated that years ago with it being very hit and miss, very updates breaking things, and you know, that kind of thing. And right. It could just be a perception where with PC stuff, because, as I say, because everyone's spec is different and everyone's pushing the envelope and buying new bits and bobs for it, you have to kind of look at the spec on the game. Every game you're buying, you've got to sit and look at all the spec to make sure and try to get an idea how it's going to run on your hardware. And there's always that risk that do you have the one graphics card that there's a known bug with, and there's an update that breaks another game. And I like the kind of the consistency of a console where it's the same piece of hardware that everyone uses. And
I hear now you can at least hook up a keyboard and mouse to an Xbox.
Oh yeah, yeah. But yeah, I just find it so much easier to where everyone's using the same spec of machine, the same hardware, and it's all tested. What you see on a video and someone else playing it, what you see at your mate's house when they're playing it, that's exactly what you're going to get. And it's all, you can guarantee it's optimized properly for the controller, because that's the controller that comes with that console, you know?
Yeah. I tend to like the struggle that you get with setting up games, figuring out what broke when there's an update, and things like that.
So, I take it, so if you're gaming on Linux then, is that the Steam app on Linux?
I do a lot from Steam, and with the advent of Proton, it's really kind of broadened my gaming experience on Linux, made things a little bit simpler. There's still a lot of games that don't work, but there's a lot more that do now.
So what is Proton then? Because I've been that's not something I've been aware of.
Proton. Technically, it's still in beta with Steam, but it is basically a port of Play on Linux.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, right. I remember that, yeah. Yeah.
And it's built into Steam, and you turn on the beta version, and it will allow you to install, well, there's two levels of that beta. There's one that allows you to install any of their approved games that they guarantee will work with Proton that are Windows games exclusives. And then there's the other level of the beta that will allow you to install and test any Windows game.
Ah.
And now, I haven't necessarily had the best of luck with it. I was able to get one of the Batman Arkham games working. And let's see, both of the Vampire the Masquerade games, a couple of others. The Dungeon Siege games installed and ran pretty well. Witcher has its own Linux port, but the Linux version is extremely terrible. So it seems to run pretty good under, I was previously running it on Play on Linux. I don't think I've installed it under Proton.
So are these the Windows versions of the games that you're getting and then running it through? Right, so it's kind of like,
Play on Linux or Lutris or a variant of Wine.
Yeah. Well, I presume I was going to say is this a Windows 10, but no, it's Linux.
Yeah, Proton came out in beta over the summer.
You know what I would love to see across the gaming industry? This is probably never going to happen. But the idea when games are multi-platform, which the vast majority are. I would love to see it where you buy a license for that game and that lets you download it on whatever platform you happen to want to play it on. Right. rather than having to buy it a second time on
Steam and only being able to install and play it on Steam. Yeah, I see that there. Now there are some of the older games especially where if you buy them on Steam, they will pop up with the activation code, and I'm pretty sure that you could take that and use it anywhere.
Yeah, I think I could be wrong, but I think the Xbox stuff is the same. Is that not the same thing? If you play the same games with the same code on Windows,
I know that Xbox, if you own it on Xbox and it is covered by if it's available, then you can also play it directly on Windows.
All right. So that might be just a kind of an additional, you pay a bit more for it on the Xbox rather than so that you can get that dual or play anywhere type of thing.
I don't know. Yeah, but I could go over the list of games that I haven't been able to get to work on Proton.
Does that tend to be just is there any kind of pattern to that? Is it just games that are like too new that haven't been updated yet, or?
Basically, I think this is kind of being community driven, and if I really wanted to, I could go out and look up the different settings. But I'm just talking about stuff that's not working out of the box. I did try some of the fixes for, like, Elder Scrolls, Skyrim.
Yeah.
But the fixes that were out there listed on the internet that other people had done and had worked for them, because of the audio issues and some of the crashing and just the game stalling out, they didn't work for me. I wasn't able to get that working properly. It will run, it will play, none of the audio works right. Same thing with Fallout 4. Grand Theft Auto Vice City plays absolutely fine. That's an older game. Quake 3 Arena plays good. Resident Evil 4 played decently. There was some issues with brightness, but that might have been something from the game itself. I have not been able to get Watch Dogs or Watch Dogs 2 to play, but that's because of Uplay and not the games themselves. Elder Scrolls 3, I wasn't able to get to play, if I remember right. Arkham Origin worked, but Arkham Asylum didn't, Arkham City didn't, and Arkham Knight didn't.
Yeah, I mean, even obviously none of these that you're talking about, I guess, are really designed to run on Linux. This is a kind of workaround to get them running on Linux.
Right.
But yeah, this is the type of thing that that I kind of remembered from way back from, well, granted, that was people trying to figure out how to play it on Windows 98 and XP and stuff. But, you know, it's just...
some of my older games.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I kind of look at that and say, well, I would rather, if I've got half an hour to play a game, I would rather just load it up and spend that half hour playing the game. Rather than spend 25 minutes trying to figure out how to get the game to work.
Well, you know, that's just the first time. After that, after you have everything all set up, it should just work unless there's an update that bricks it. But
yeah.
I like working on this type of stuff. So, and I went, because I haven't bought anything from there, but I'm also looking at GOG's collection of Linux games. I think I might eventually try one of those. Have you seen GOG before?
I know of it. As far as I'm aware, GOG is really a PC gaming platform.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't play games on the PC. So, I didn't even think about it until a few months ago was the Humble Bundle. Again, I figured they would be PC only as well. And then I saw something about a deal on PlayStation games through there. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know they did them. So, but yeah, GOG. Are they owned by CD Projekt Red? What's the connection between them and CD Projekt Red?
I have no clue. Like I said, I haven't used it before. I just went to their site because I remember hearing about them. And I'm looking through to see if there's anything that I'd like to buy and test out.
There was something about some controversy on that appeared on, I think it was Twitter maybe a couple of months ago, and it was something that had came from GOG, and then people were talking about, boycott CD Projekt Red, and I'm like, what? What? What's, I don't get the connection, like, maybe one of them owns the other, or I don't know.
CD Projekt.
That's the people behind The Witcher, and they're the people that make The Witcher, Cyberpunk, is it? The one that's going to be coming out probably late on this year or next year or something.
Yeah. They had a preview at E3, and it looked really cool. Their Cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2077.
That did look good. I would like to play that one, but I don't know if it's going to be possible. Cyberpunk 2077, okay.
Of all of these, I play older games. I'm on quite a budget, so I play a lot of older games. I stopped gaming for so long. And then I picked it back up. I've got back into it. So there's lots and lots of games that are old to lots of people, but they're new to me. And I'm sort of working my way through them. I'm in no rush. So,
what are you playing?
Well, I've been working my way through Uncharted 1 and 2, almost halfway through Uncharted 3. I did... God of War. See, when I came back into gaming, I'd always been a PlayStation. I'd always been down the PlayStation route. But I'd sort of stopped gaming for a good decade. When I got back into it, I thought, you know, I've never had an Xbox. So apparently the Xbox One, decent console, go with that. So I did, and I was quite happy. And I started researching games that, what's changed in the last decade plus? What franchises have came up? What games did I used to think were good that have fallen by the wayside, that kind of thing? And I saw a video on God of War, and it was just, oh, that just blew my mind. It was like, God of War is awesome. So immediately, I did not realise it was that was an exclusive at the time. So I'm watching this on YouTube, on my Xbox One. I'm pausing that. I'm going into the Microsoft store. I'm going to see how much that is. Couldn't find it. I was like, okay, back to the drawing board. And then I found it was a PS4 exclusive. So it was the one game that basically tipped me over the edge, that said, I've got to get a PS4. It was God of War. And then just in the... And the January sales there, it's down to £23. So yeah, I pounced on that. I've not actually installed it yet. But yeah, when it came round to the January sales and the PSN store, it's like, that's got to be a mistake at that price.
I tend to not like games that are based around microtransactions, or their entire gameplay is just online. So I play a lot of older games because of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working my way through a lot of single player stuff. I don't tend to do multiplayer.
Right.
So I'm doing like the single player, obviously, but Uncharted is single player. I think fourth one, which I don't have. I believe that's got a multiplayer side to it. But yeah, it's. I think that's the older games, the remastered stuff that I never played the first time round. So yeah, I got God of War and just about 2 weeks ago, a week ago, something like that. I've not tried it yet. I've not installed it yet, but yeah, it's definitely on the list. That's the only one that comes even close to buying that game. Well, I think that's in the same year that it was released, a major AAA title that I've bought in the same calendar year that it was released. Now, granted, that was back in April, but still, it counts. Yeah, most of the games that I get are, look at the older ones, the collections, the ultimate editions, the ones complete with all the DLC and wait till they're on sales and things like that.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking through. I'm not sure which is newer, if it's Witcher 2 or Watch Dogs, but those are about the newest games that I'm playing.
I guess
the Arkham games are extremely new as well, so...
Yeah. I've got The Witcher... The Wild Collection or something like that, the one that's The Witcher 3 that has the Wild Hunt and stuff with it. I started that, but it was one of these. It's on the list. It's definitely on the list. When it comes to the gaming media, all the big releases and news over titles and stuff coming out. I'm sort of watching that and kind of keeping an eye on the mental note. Like, yeah, once that arrives and it's at a good price, then I'll get that. And of all the E3 stuff, the one that just dropped my jaw was Swords of Tsushima, Blades of Tsushima. It's a samurai one.
Hold on. Blades of
Tsushima. T-S-H-U. Yeah, it's basically, it's a whole open world, sort of 14th century by the looks of it. Samurai, when you're fighting the Mongol invaders, and it's very, very, like, I'm a fan of history.
Okay, Ghost of Tsushima?
Ghost of Tsushima, that's what it is. That's what it okay. is. Yeah, Ghost of Tsushima.
PS4 exclusive.
Yep. I'm quite a fan of history, so I like, obviously, games are, they always take liberties to tell the story, and some more so than others. But Ghost of Tsushima, I wish it had a more pronounceable name.
Right.
That's one of these things that, initially when I was watching the demo, I thought, yeah, okay, it looks good, but is it going to be the same sort of westernized, impression, kind of faux samurai, combat and whatever, well, the swords banging against each other, and then when it came to the actual, the sword or the fighting section of the demo, where it was like two gunslingers facing off, and then just getting ready and with the counter attack, and I was like, oh yes, yes, these guys care, these people really care. That's authentic as hell. So,
I will be back in a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Is sound ever an issue on Steam?
I would imagine that they've kind of got that sorted, but then again, I mean, what other platforms? I keep thinking of Steam as Windows gaming or PC gaming. Is that fair? Is that, I mean, do people, what is Steam just like a kind of a portal? A store, a kind of single client where you keep track of all your scores and all your buddies and all that kind of thing. Or is it still pretty normal to play games outside of the Steam store, just individual games on the PC?
I think it just through the Steam client. I put it on Slackware last week.
I know EA have got their own. Origins, I think it is. I'm guessing that must be the same kind of idea with the client. It doesn't look very good though, but they've got their own kind of version of that. Are Steam boxes still a thing? Or have they kind of been and gone and never really took off? Or?
Yeah, I'm going to have to do some family stuff for a while. I'll probably try to jump on later.
Oh, have fun.
It was good talking to you though.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
I don't think they have Steam boxes in the store anymore.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, maybe, I was talking about the fabled year of the Linux desktop, which is every year. But one of them was, oh, there's the Steam client and the Steam boxes and whatever. That's, and then there's like 7 or 8 different models by different people or different companies with different specs and things, and then you've got the obvious one for people who are kind of tech savvy, is, well, why would you buy something that's pre-built? Why don't you just build it yourself and install the Steam, a bare bones Linux, like an Ubuntu or something like that, and the Linux Steam client, yeah.
It seems to work otherwise. I just was trying to get it on a demo video, and I couldn't even get the demo video played, and I just couldn't hear any sound. I just didn't know if it was something I did wrong.
There are some kind of oddballs like that. Even, I mean, stepping that aside from the gaming, I'd set up the OpenELEC, installed OpenELEC as a Kodi box, and found that it didn't seem to pick up the sound on a lot of codecs. I could not figure out how to fix it. So, and then the kind of just gave up and went back to like Zubuntu with the Kodi app rather than OpenELEC, which is that's what it's designed to do. So yeah, it's strange. Is that possibly a licensing thing, or
you'd think the licensing would be taken care of when you bought the game?
Yeah, no, I mean the hardware for actually playing it on. If you're if you're not getting the sound, is that possibly to do with the codecs not being installed because of licensing? The sound is there, but you need the codec for it.
It might be just how I have Slackware configured. I'm still a little bit new to Pulse Audio, so maybe I just didn't do something right on there.
Oh yeah, Pulse Audio. Pulse Audio's. I remember when it was incredibly iffy and frustrating, but that seems to have improved a lot.
I'm starting to think it might work better, and maybe just on an Ubuntu stick, just so I can boot in to only that to try out Steam, because it's just all new to me, this part of it.
Anyone out there got the radio on?
I'm here.
Hi, Honky.
How you doing?
Not too bad. It's been very quiet for the last half hour.
So I've noticed. I just got out of work, and I'm on my commute home, and figured I'd pop on and listen, maybe chime in a little bit. It's been pretty quiet.
Hope you're not driving.
I am, but Plumble is nice enough that all I got to do is push a little button and I can still keep my eyes on the road.
Right, so you're using the mobile app for Mumble?
Yeah, Plumble. It's pretty good.
Brilliant. So what brings you here into HPR land?
Well, actually, I helped organize this event.
Oh, brilliant. That's great. So you're one of Gay Wish's crew?
Yeah, Kevin Wishard, actually, he did a lot for setting the thing up this year. And, yeah, it's me, Kevin, and Ken are basically the ones who set this up. I'm the one who was going to have the fun afterwards of doing the audio editing and getting all the show notes together. Excuse me.
Ah, I don't envy you that task. I've been doing it, some of the audio editing for Mintcast for the last few weeks. And I know how difficult that is just with an hour and a half, 2 hour show. So trying to put 24 hours together is going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, but it's you got to take it and then figure out how many hours you want each section to be. So whatever you get for amount of time. So like in the past, it's been like 21 hours after you truncate silence. And then you want to figure out how many hours you want each segment to be, and then you just got to figure out where in the conversation you can break it during that time. I mean, it's a task, but it's you know, unlike in the past, we're not worried about trying to do it really quickly, so I have all the time that I need to be able to just sit down and do it. But that's the easy part. The hard part is I have to go back and listen to all 21 hours and then make sure that the show notes match up with what was talked about during that segment. So the audio editing isn't that big of a deal. It's the getting the show notes lining up with the audio that's the pain.
Yeah, so I take it you're recording in Mumble. You're obviously recording separate tracks, are you?
No, we're not recording separate tracks. I don't have a lot of great experience, recording in separate tracks and putting it all together. So I also do a podcast called the Linux Lugcast. It's like me, 5150, actually Joe, who's on the Mintcast with you, he comes on, and we have another guy, Netminer, who will probably be popping in sooner or later. But when I do it that way, we do it all in just one audio recording, and basically I just run it through a script, and it's a lot easier. There's a lot trying to do the recording with multiple tracks is if you're all starting at the same time and all ending at the same time, it works out pretty well. But if like people pop in the middle, it messes everything up.
Yeah, I can understand that. Joe's been around today, but he's had to pop off and go and do some family stuff.
Yeah, and I think you guys have been doing a great job with the main cast. I really really like the new crew.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. You know, it's my first experience of doing a multi-person podcast. I've obviously done a few HPR episodes, but I haven't done kind of a crew cast before.
I find I always work better with more people. If I have somebody I can talk to and bounce things off of, I feel like you're going to get more out of me and you're going to get something better out of me than if you just sit me down in front of a microphone and have me blather on for a while.
Yeah, I enjoy the interaction. I've just remembered I actually have had a little bit of experience before I joined the Minkgrass cast crew, because I did the Full Circle podcast for a few episodes, but apart from that, which we did until about 3 or 4 years ago, I haven't had that much experience, and I wasn't doing any of the audio at the time.
Now, I know the Linux Slugcast doesn't have the same audio quality as you guys strive for, but I'm telling you, I have it set up right now where I got some help from some other people and put up together a bash script that uses SOX to process the audio. I use SOX. I use a script that I forget his name, came up with, that helps with the audio tagging the files. All right, so HPR, when you go listen to the community news, the two basic people are Ken Fallon and, why am I blanking on the other guy?
Dave Morris.
Dave Morris, thank you. Sorry, Dave. Sorry. Dave's been a big help with a lot of stuff. I'm just blanking on his name.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, Dave. I actually joined in the community show a few weeks ago, just before we were doing a Mintcast recording. So, yeah, it was good to meet up with them on the community.
So what made you want to join the Mintcast?
Well, I've been a user of Mint since the early... Well, for me, when Ubuntu went over to the Unity desktop, I'd been playing around with Mint up till then, but kind of Unity forced me over to Mint full-time. And I've been listening to the podcast since the early days. And they put out a call a few years ago for hosts, and that's when Joe Ressington joined the crew. But at the time I was working, so I couldn't join. But I've since retired, and when they put the call out earlier on this year, I thought, yeah, I'll see it. I'll put my head up on the parapet and see what happens. And Rob got in touch and said, come and join us, and the rest's history, as they say.
Now, you guys ever talked about trying to split the crew up into, like, because how many guys are there? There are six?
Yeah, we've ended up with six. There was eight people expressed interest. One of the guys isn't able to record on the night we record because of work commitments, and the other person has did a couple of shows and then has dropped out. So, yeah, there's six of us, although, Moss couldn't join us last night because he wasn't well.
Now, have you guys thought about doing, like, splitting it up with, like, three one week and three the next week or something like that? Not that I don't appreciate the six people all together. I was just spitballing.
We talked about it, but so far it seems to be working okay. There will be episodes when, for whatever reason, like last night when Moss couldn't join us, or I'm going to be away during the year at times when I won't be able to join. So I think there'll be episodes where you won't get the full crew. But so far it seems to be working okay. And Leo's doing a great job as, the main host and keeping us all in check.
Yeah, like I said, I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, the big thing's been coordinating the audio and getting the Audacity files together at the end of it. We had, last couple of episodes, we've had a bit of problem with a little bit of clipping, but we seem to have resolved that now. Last night's recording seemed to go all right.
Now you take all six audio files and then you plug them into Audacity and line them up?
Yeah, that's what we've been doing. So before the actual we start the full recording, we do a counting. We do some silence so that we can strip out any background noise from your local mic. And then just before we run the intro, we do another counting, and that gives us 2 points that we can sync the audio to. Hi, Netminder.
Hello, friends.
Hi.
Hey, Netminder.
I forgot about the time.
The push to talk.
Yes, I've been fighting with the audio interface here, so push to talk does work.
Yeah, can hear you loud and clear. The voice sounds slightly familiar. Are you a Lugcast participant?
Yes, I'm the representative Indian.
We don't have minorities on this show.
Well, that is to say, I'm the official non-host of Linux Lugcast.
Ah, right. So you're one of the ones that just gate crashes it occasionally?
No, I just play sidekick, let the other guys host.
Right. We've just been talking. I'm one of the new Mint Cast crew. Don't know whether you listen to that show.
I don't do as many podcasts as I should, and I've heard of Mintcast, but unfortunately I have not listened to it.
You want to listen in a couple of weeks' time? We've got our 300th episode, and we're going to do something slightly different.
Well, thank you for the heads up. I've used Mint, our nice system. I'm a refugee from Windows 7 after Microsoft started messing around pushing Windows 10.
Oh, I jumped ship when they brought out Vista. That killed me.
Well, I have been studying Linux. Back in the day, I had briefly, before I forked it, a 386SX machine with Linux on it. Yes, it was a snail, but it was a racing snail. It was a 40 megahertz 386SX.
Yeah, but everything was a snail back in them days.
Well, the SX being 16-bit bus was slower than the regular 386. So I had a turbocharged mini, basically.
Right. We had a 386 in the house, but I never used to use it because it was on DOS. So the only time, at that time when we had that in the house, the only computing I used to do used to be at work. And then a few years later, I managed to get hold of a Windows 98 machine.
Well, I've got a couple of DOS boxes still in the house.
Ah, proper old-time pro.
Well, actually, they're a bit bigger. They're P1s, and they're running the new FreeDOS, which is pretty maxed out.
I would imagine DOS would fly on a P1, wouldn't it?
It does pretty good. I haven't been hacking them lately, but you can get internet up, you can get FTP and stuff. I'm planning on them as just basically operating in the house net, not on the world.
Yeah, keep it free of any nasty intrusions.
Yep. Also, surprisingly, for those who may be trying the retro game, I've got USB 2 working pretty well for mass storage, so I can hang flash drives off of it and stuff, DOS formatted.
I was going to say, did they actually make drivers for DOS then, for USB?
Well, if you dig around, you can find drivers for DOS and USB pretty well. I found that the driver was a little finicky about which card it would talk to, but partitioning a drive with Gparted gets you the most bang for your buck as far as gigabyte storage. But, you know, it was quite acceptable. Also, I have CF cards for a boot device.
Now, I don't even know what that is. I'm showing my ignorance here.
Compact flash.
Ah, right, sorry. Yeah, compact flash cards. I remember them well. You don't see many of them around now.
Well, the thing is that the compact flash pinout in protocol is the same as the IDE, so it's pretty much DOS native except the translation language.
All right, I hadn't realized that. So what's your current main setup?
current main setup is Ubuntu 18.04.
Yeah, I'm currently running Mate 18.04 on a HP tower I've got, but I've got Linux Mint on laptops, etc. Just upgraded to 19.1 on most of them.
Well, I'm definitely an XFCE man, most things, although I have tried other desktops, and I've tried a variety from Linux Lite on up.
Yeah, XFCE is quite a nice piece of kit. I used to use it back in the day when I was rescuing old Pentium 1s and Pentium 2s, because it was the desktop environment that I'd actually work on low spec hardware. But these days, where resources aren't really an issue, I enjoy the Mate respin of the old GNOME 2 environment.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Mate and Cinnamon's retro element.
Yeah, it's horses for courses, isn't it? You know, we all find something that we're comfortable with. Personally, for me, as a daily driver, XFCE is just a little bit too pared down for me. So that's why I've stuck with Mate over the years.
Well, I can understand that. But again, as some of my machines my best machines are Windows 7 era machines, so I've tried to stay a little light on the interface.
Believe it or not, I've just put Mint 19.1 onto an old Lenovo X61S little laptop, about 11 and a half years old. All right, I've upgraded it to an SSD and it's got the full 4 gig of RAM. But Mint 19.1 Mate runs sweet on it.
I'll have to see. I've got a single core Athlon 64 that I might be looking for a system for.
Yeah, depending on what the other specs are of the machine, you might find that Mint runs quite well on it.
I think it's certainly two gigs and has a 6450 HD graphics. It's quite slow, but then again, I put it together largely as a server, so the graphics side is not a big deal.
Yeah, that's the great thing about old laptops. You can usually find some use for them, particularly as little servers around the house or whatever.
This is an old E-machine tower, actually, but I used it to teach me hacking on more modern hardware, not digging into my main machine.
Cool.
So what have people been doing?
It's been a mixed bag. I didn't come on until about... I'm in the UK, by the way, obviously. So local time for me, it was just coming up to 1 o'clock when I joined. And I came on for an hour or so and then disappeared, just come back on about 7 o'clock. But when I was on earlier on, we were talking about all sorts of stuff, talking about HPR shows and various things. It's quite interesting, the breadth and depth of different conversations.
Yeah, I've been doing some looking around to getting into software-defined radio, thinking of using some of my older machines as front ends and having the display stuff run on my more modern stuff at the other end. That's a nice thing about Linux. I could put a Pi upstairs with the SDR and then remote anything that needs heavy lifting to better machines.
Yeah, I was thinking a Raspberry Pi would do that really great. You can actually get kits for the Raspberry Pi for those kind of things.
Well, I've got some old 32-bitters for proof of concept, and then I'd go to a Pi.
Sounds good. What software-defined radio would you use then?
I've been looking at I've been looking at this RSP-1A. It's about $100 US or £100, I believe. It's a pretty good purpose-built system. But then again, for $20, you can get the original RTL SDR TV receiver dongle. So it depends on how big a bite I want to take the first time.
Sounds good.
Yeah, well, some of the $100 unit is is, I think, 12-bit sound, so it's much better quality and much better hardware, but the cheap one would allow me to work the bugs out and then upgrade.
So are you into ham radio as well, or is this just for listening stuff?
I used to be more into shortwave and general coverage uses. Also, with Linux and appropriate software, you can go a lot of places, from aircraft listening to weather, both forecasts and imagery.
Right.
I'm a listener, but generally speaking, I don't do any transmission, but I would like to be able to explore the variety of information out there.
Yeah, I remember as a kid having a shortwave radio and used to trawl the airwaves to see what was out there, but it never really, once I left school and started work and stuff, it never really grabbed me to go and do anything else. Hi, 51. It's a lot of jumping around the various lounges and rooms at the moment.
Dummy's here, but this is my first season mumble, so let me know if I'm doing it wrong.
You're coming through loud and clear. Have you got push-to-talk enabled? That seems to be the preference around here.
Yes, I do. Loud and clear, is that too loud or just about right?
Seems fine to me. It wasn't deafening me, if that's what you were worried about.
Good enough. So I'll be around all day, but I'll be working, so I don't know how much I'll be contributing. But
where are you, DOD?
I'm in Louisville, Kentucky.
Cool. I'm in Blackpool in the UK.
And this might be interesting to some folks in the crowd, but I work on Whiskey Row.
Now, what's that?
It's a famous place for whiskey in Louisville, Kentucky. Like Old Forester, Maker's Mark. Basically, it's kind of like a bar row for whiskey. Apparently, it's pretty famous. I don't drink whiskey much. I don't drink much. But apparently, this is kind of a on the tourist attractions for bourbon. I think bourbon is the, I might even get that wrong because I don't really drink much, but I think bourbon's the main attraction.
So it's a bit of a connoisseur's kind of tourist place.
It's not really touristy, but bourbon's here. So, and the Kentucky Derby. So, but it doesn't really count to me as a tourist place, but I guess that would be the tourist attraction.
All right, cool. So, have I seen your name on HPR episodes?
Yeah, I've done a couple of the lower quality episodes.
I thought the handle was recognizable.
That's probably because it's funny listening to Ken say my handle. But I've been following HPR since before it was HPR. Actually, since before, I think before it was TWAT radio. I remember hearing some discussion about it when it was being thought about, so at least from pretty much the very beginning.
So in HPR land, you're a real old timer then?
Yeah, from the listening, I don't attribute much. Probably my first show was maybe 4 years ago.
Yeah, my first show was only two or three years ago, so I've been listening for quite some time, but didn't contribute for quite some time.
Ken lowered the bar and made it too easy, so I had to.
He's got a habit of nagging you. If he knows you, he nags and nags until you give in. Welcome, Archer.
It seems the folks slipping into the lounge are doing so by accident.
It's the default place that everyone goes to first because the channel's used for so many other different things. Because we record Mintcast in this server as well. So there's different channels once you get in, but everyone goes into the lounge first.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Lugcast uses a similar system. Of course, the lounge is just stacked in a different place.
Yeah, I suppose the setup's slightly different depending on the server you've got set up. Archer, can you hear us now? Oh, he's got mute on. Yeah, Miner, I'm going to just desert you for a few minutes because I need to go and take a bathroom stop and refresh my coffee. But I'll be back in about 5 or 10.
Well, that's fine with me. I'm just glad somebody's here.
Okay, I'll be back shortly. Anyone else join Netminder, Miner?
There's nobody new on right now.
Hi, Mongo.
I haven't really said anything, but I've been listening for a while. I'm having lunch and just sitting around now.
Okay.
And what's this coffee stuff? I thought tea was the thing of England.
Yeah, I drink tea or coffee. I actually just had a cup of tea, so it just depends what I feel like at the time.
In case you didn't get it, I'm just teasing.
No, I guess that. I think tea's got a bad press because of that little party they had in Boston a few hundred years ago.
We're not mad anymore.
Probably the best that Boston Harbor has tasted in a while.
Probably.
I've had to give up coffee recently because of my delicate stomach, so I drink tea now pretty much every day. I cheat and get coffee about once a week.
Yeah, I have to be careful how much caffeine I drink and how much of the acidic kind of coffees that I drink. I have to take everything with milk these days.
Yeah, it's the acid. It's my stomach burns for days sometimes. I can't eat pepperoni anymore. That just, I'd give up coffee twice to eat a pepperoni pizza.
Well, being a vegetarian, I won't join you in that one.
Isn't pepperoni vegetarian?
No, I think it's something to do with the pork they put in it.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't grow on trees, does it?
Not quite.
In that case, I guess I don't eat any vegetables.
Well, for New Year's Eve, because I'm on certain medications, I can't celebrate the way most do.
I haven't been able to celebrate in that way for the last 32 years, so it's no hardship for me.
Well, my dad did enough celebrating for several generations.
That sounds like a hard 32 years. I don't know what you're talking about, no hardship.
No, I actually enjoy being sober. It's been the best part of my life.
Well, sir, my hat's off to you.
You could probably buy a house with what you save from drinking.
Well, put it this way, when I used to drink and smoke, if I was doing all that now, I'd probably be bankrupt. I don't know how much a pack of cigarettes are in America these days, but they're about $13 or $14 over here.
Yeah, I think they're like $140 here or something.
What, for a pack of 20?
Is that how many's in a pack?
Yeah.
No, I think it's like $6 or $7, $8. I don't really know. I don't buy them. They've gotten silly with it. Either, you know, if you don't want people to smoke, just make it illegal for them to smoke. And then it'll be like, oh, you can't smoke marijuana. Oh, okay, we won't do that anymore. And that'll work just fine. Otherwise, you know, as far as taxing it, it just hurts poor people. You know, they don't want to tax it too much because then they wouldn't get the revenue because people really might stop smoking.
Yeah, smoking rates in the UK have really plummeted. I don't know about on your side of the pond, but over here it's gone really low compared with what it used to be.
Yeah, people smoke a lot less, but you know their reasoning is kind of crazy because they said that they justified raising the taxes on cigarettes and well tobacco products because it would give you it make you sick and then that would cost the society money from having to put you in the hospital and get you treat your cancer and stuff. But really, if you go ahead and just die from your cancer or whatever at typically around the a good heavy smoker would normally work their 40 odd years, retire at 65 and then die. And then they wouldn't have to pay them Social Security. Actually, it saves the government a lot of money if people smoke. I don't know why they don't encourage it.
That's a very cynical viewpoint.
It's not cynical at all. It just shows the lie when they say how they're doing it to save money in the medical, when it's BS, when they could take that money, any money they spend, because they're going to spend it. If they're going to pay for you when you're sick, if they pay 25 years of Social Security and then they pay for your Alzheimer's care, is it better? Wouldn't it be better just to pay for a little bit of lung problem care and then bury you when you're 65 or 68 or something? I think that'd be better.
I'm not sure about that.
I think there's enough money to pay for it all myself. Bezos could pay for half of all of it himself.
Yeah, slightly different system over here. We've got the National Health Service, so it really does come out of taxpayers' money.
Well, doesn't that make sense?
I suppose in a left-handed way it does make sense, but I think there's a lot of money spent on just the actual health costs of people who smoke. Let alone the economic costs of working days lost, etc., etc.
I think if they go ahead and die, if they're good smokers, they'll go ahead and die and won't cost you as much in the long run, though.
Yeah, but before they get there, there'll be economic costs before they actually get there.
Well, I'm looking at the long game. Yes, you remember when they get old, the non-smokers get old, they get sick too. They just get some, a little something different, but they cost money to keep them alive, keep them all those years, and then they get sick before they die. So it's not like it actually makes fiscal sense to keep people alive longer. Once people stop working, it doesn't make sense to keep them around. Now, I'm not complaining. I don't work anymore either, but and I'm not in any big rush to get it on. As far as people saying that they're doing it, they're against people smoking because they want people to be healthier and stuff. Or the economics part of it, at least. Yeah, they're lying.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but it's very complicated economics and the costs of everything. And what's going to save money and what's going to cost money?
That's the problem with sin tax. The government gets addicted to the sin as well. Whether you use it or not, everybody's addicted.
Yeah, the latest one's sugar and fat, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and if you tax it, then your government dependent upon the tax, so you can't really stamp it out then.
That's where they want to, you tax it to the point where it is, you got the most income without cutting back too much on the people who actually stop doing it. You don't want to stop people from the behavior. You just want to maximize the income.
Well, a lot of people say that's why prohibition, it wasn't because prohibition wasn't working. Everybody knew that, but the government looked at the fact that they weren't getting the tax money.
Yeah, it was also costing them money to try and enforce the law that wasn't working.
Yeah, well, once they made it legal, they could put the sin taxes back on, and they made their money that way.
Did you know that, well, in the U.S. at least, I don't know if it's that way now, but at least the way it used to be is that the tax for beer, which is the working man's form of drinking alcohol, the tax is significantly higher for the amount of alcohol than it is for whiskey, which is the sophisticated, the government guys, that's what they drink. That's what the guy in the Senate drinks.
So what would you pay for a typical 16-ounce bottle of booze in America?
I pay about $9 for a six-pack of beer. It's six 12-ounce bottles or cans.
But what about a 16-ounce pint bottle of liquor?
Oh, liquor. Let's see. You would normally you get that in fifths or liters. A fifth is a fifth of a gallon, which is obviously less than a quart, which is less than a liter. So depends on what you're looking at. Vodka anywhere from $10 to almost $30. Whiskies are more like, if it's any good at all, pretty close to 20 to as high as you want to spend.
Yeah, but relative to the alcohol content, like you say, there's more out of bang for your buck if you buy the spirits.
Well, the tax is based on the amount of alcohol and the type of liquor it is. So if you just want to get drunk, you want to go with cheap stuff, like really cheap whiskey or I think wine. I think maybe the $4 a bottle kind of wine might be the way to go. Way to go if you just want to get the most alcohol and you don't really care that much about what it tastes like. You can get cheaper beer than what I buy, and you can, although you can't get much cheaper vodka than I would drink, because I don't drink good vodka. If I drink whiskey, it's not real expensive, but at least it's not real cheap. But I hardly ever drink whiskey. I bought one bottle of whiskey this entire year, but I probably bought 4 or 5 bottles of vodka.
Yeah, it's similar over here in the UK that there's the cheap spirits, and then you get into the more connoisseur stuff, and obviously the connoisseur stuff's really expensive, but all the people who want to just drink to get drunk, they go for the cheap stuff.
Yeah, a certain amount of it, for wine, I usually spend, just for drinking, I'll drink $5, $6, white wine, but if I, for a decent bottle of wine for drinking with dinner or something, I might buy a red wine that costs somewhere around $12 to $15. More than that is just wasting money. I can kind of tell the difference up to about $25. Anything more than that, it's somebody else has to have bought the bottle, and then I can't tell the difference. The most expensive alcohol I've ever drunk is champagne, and I can tell you, for me, $15 champagne and $100 champagne is pretty much identical.
They've done loads of customer satisfaction surveys over here, and they've found that out, that the cheaper champagnes, if you get a reasonably cheaper champagne, they can be just as good as the really expensive, $50 to $100 bottles.
That's my opinion. I've had several bottles of $100+ champagne that somebody else has bought, and when I bought it, $4 or $5 champagne is not good, but $12 to $15 or so is not bad champagne, and tastes pretty much like the $100 stuff. And I've never bought anything like $40. Yeah, if there is such a thing, it's like I quit when it gets like, this is pretty good. It tastes pretty much like $100 stuff.
Yeah, sounds a pretty similar story to over here. Like I say, though, it doesn't particularly worry me because I don't drink the stuff.
Yeah, I understand, and every now and then I don't drink for a while, but I tend to drink some. Over the years, I haven't drunk a lot. I drank a little more now that I'm retired, because if I decide to start drinking at 8 in the morning, I can't if I want to. When you work, you can't do that. So I started drinking a little bit more, but I'm still not a heavy drinker. I've never been a heavy drinker, but I like British beers. That's kind of the pale ales are kind of my thing. Although I sometimes do the IPA, but that's British too originally, I think.
Yeah, the Indian pale ales were originally manufactured so that they could send them to the troops in India when they were traveling over there during our empire. So. And it kept on the traveling wise.
Yeah, they're bitter enough not to lose their bitter, I guess.
Yeah, have you got this craze that we've started in this country where we get these microbreweries and they just produce enough for one or two bars.
They just produce one or two what?
We in this country we've got they give a tax incentive if you're not producing a massive amount of beer. They don't tax it quite as heavily. So what's happened recently is we've got craze where these microbreweries, so they just brew enough beer to serve the bar or one or two bars. Most of the time they're actually brewing the beer on the premises where they're actually selling it.
Every state in the U.S. is different, and the liquor laws are all local. Most of it's, you know, some of the taxing is at federal, and I guess there's some federal controls, but basically things like that are done at the state level. I think it's probably Texas I live in Texas. It was one of the last states to have microbreweries because, there's a really big Budweiser plant here in Houston, and I hate to tell you this, but you can, $30,000 or $40,000 used to buy you an entire, just a very significant part of our state legislature, and you could purchase them for a session for a really reasonable fee, and so you couldn't open a microbrewery. You literally had to. The law at one time said that something like, in order to sell beer that was brewed on the premises, you had to sell at least some really, really, really large amount of, you had to make a certain amount of beer. And it just happened to be the amount that no brewery in Texas made except that one brewery in Houston was the only one that made that much. Also, that brewery had to be in a city that was at least a million people or something, which only like two places in Texas were big enough to do that. So it essentially meant only one place in Texas could you have a brew pub, and that was on the site at the Budweiser brewery. And that's the way it was here for decades, and until most states in the U.S. had had microbreweries. And eventually, it's been 20 years now since they stopped that, but that was kind of how it was set up for a very long time, and I think that's the way it is now, but I think that you can still procure, Texas legislators pretty cheaply.
Yeah, that's big corporate muscle, isn't it? Keeping the small guys out.
But there's a lot of nice, local breweries. I drink, mostly local beers, not entirely, and when I don't, most of the other ones are fairly small breweries in other places. I like beers from Oregon and Colorado. Every now and then I drink beers from England.
So what beer would you drink from England then?
Newcastle is, the most recent one I've had, but, there's something called Speckled Hen
I've heard that one
that I had recently, and I drink lots of different stuff. I say because I'll go in thinking, oh, I'm gonna buy this, and I get there and they don't have any, so I say, oh darn, what am I gonna get? And so I just look and see, oh, I don't think I tried this one. So the description will be something that's, oh, I like this type. Let me try that. And that's how I got the Speckled Hen thing. It had an interesting story. If you put an interesting story on the package, I'm going to buy it. And that one, it was some story about an MG automobile that got speckled from sitting next to where they were spraying paint or bird droppings or something. I don't remember what the hen, it was actually it was a car. It wasn't a chicken, this is an interesting story. Let me try this beer. I think I bought a couple of six packs.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the story's true though.
Well, for one thing, there's at least two separate stories. I later got on the internet, and they admitted they didn't know what was true on the website for the thing, and it told two different versions of it on the website. So but it had something to do with that car. It's just they weren't sure exactly what the story was, like I say, you got a story, I'm gonna stop and read it, and I might buy your beer.
Yeah, good marketing.
But to the question, I do think that the microbreweries had a kind of a bump, but I want to guess it's 10 to 15 years ago, just based on, I drink about one beer a year, so, but based on the places I've seen, I would say maybe 10 to 15 years ago we really went through that. That's how it looks to me.
Yeah, I'm not very good with dates. I don't know when they were. I know that West Coast is always ahead of everything else over here, and California, Oregon, I think Oregon's really famous for their microbreweries, and that's the first place I ever had a local beer. It certainly wasn't Texas where I live, but I don't know exactly how long ago it was, whether it was 20 years ago or 10 years ago. Before that, I was drinking more either English. I used to drink Fuller's, ESB, and I used to drink German beers a lot. But once I stopped drinking Budweiser, which I couldn't drink a can now at all. But I've drunk plenty of it.
Have you ever had a bottle of the stuff from Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic as it is now, the original Bud brewery?
You know, I actually had some just not too long ago. That was a Czech beer. I don't know that it was from the original Bud brewery. What was the name of that? It came in a 4-pack, 16 ounces a can, and each can was decorated differently, but it was all the same beer. It was a lager. I don't drink many lagers, but European lagers are usually a little better than the American ones. I know about the name, I have been aware of the story about the name. I don't recall much about it right now, but I remember that it's like the only place in the world you can't sell American Budweiser because of the name.
That's right, yeah.
Well, they're better off for it.
Yeah, I had a couple of bottles of the old Bud before I ended my drinking career, and it wasn't the best experience I've ever had.
Oh, I've even had warm beer in London at a place where they back about, 35 years ago, when some pubs didn't refrigerate, the beer wasn't cold. And it was cool, but it wasn't cold. And I don't know what it's like now. I haven't been to London lately, but the first time I went, it was, actually the most recent time I've been there. The only time, have I only been there once? I think I've only been there once, about 35 years ago.
Well, traditionally, cask-conditioned ale was never refrigerated because it was kept in cellars, which were, you know, a cool temperature. They were, you know, they were below the temperature in the main bar. So they were, you know, they were cool, but they were never refrigerated because it was a natural beer.
Hey, and they're designed as such, and the flavors were probably tweaked for that to be, that's the drinking temperature, and I had no problem with them. I mean, I can drink warm beer. I can drink pretty much anything, but, I think it was like I was at that time I was still drinking Budweiser, I think, and cold, because you sure couldn't drink it warm. And I go there, I go in a pub, and I just get whatever the local beer is, and it's not even cold. I'm going, is this right? You know, I didn't complain about it, but I don't think it would have done me any good. And I figured it out after I had a couple of beers there over, you know, in different places, that, oh, they don't. It's not cold. It's not supposed to be cold. And it was good beer too.
Yeah, I was going to
say it was because it had hundreds and thousands of years being made and drunk without refrigeration.
Well, there was a joke with some motorcycle guys that I used to hang with when I was young that British beer is served warm because of Lucas refrigeration.
I was going to say that there's a campaign over in this country called the Campaign for Real Ale. And I remember when they first started producing fancy pressurized beers that kept forever. And they started putting them through coolers, and they campaigned against them for the real deal.
For those who may not have followed British motorcycle maintenance, Lucas Electrics are known to be, well, they're not the most reliable systems ever invented.
Right. What bike did you used to ride?
Oh, I didn't ride, but a couple of friends of mine did. I hung around with a whole bunch of people.
So you've never been a Harley man, then?
Not really. Although some of my friends were Harley people. A buddy of mine had a big BMW, and which he had to turn over the valve covers because they were getting a little worn.
Yeah, I used to ride a bike over in this country, but no longer.
When I was young, I always wanted a Norton the Triumphs were big favors, but the Norton back in the late 60s was just really, really what I wanted. I ended up riding Kawasaki's later on.
Yeah, but even those 60s Nortons and Triumphs, they were leaking machines. It was only when the Japs came along and started producing ones that didn't spew oil all over your garden path that they started to tighten up things.
Oh, I did know that. I mean, it's not like you don't know those things. I actually had a friend that had a Triumph TR4 automobile, and it was just a real problem. He said he spent more time under it than in it, but he still loved it.
Yeah, I had an old Mini 30-odd years ago, and it used to drink more oil than it did petrol.
I had a Morris Minor in his late 60s that was, it was pretty close. The amount of oil I put in the gasoline, it got in excess of 40 miles to the gallon of gas, and I put a pint of oil in it every time I filled up the gas.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, well, Harleys were also known to mark their territory back in the day.
Yeah, I think a lot of the early motorcycles were like that. It was when the better quality engineering came in the 70s and the 80s that things started to get better.
You know, you mentioned the Japanese bikes, and it could be that they just said, hey, look, we can do it. Why can't you? And they said, oh, crap, I guess we could too if you wanted to. I guess we will.
Yeah.
Well, you want to hear somebody curse, though? I think it's, what was it? ATF or TRW that bought Harley for a while, one of those big conglomerates.
Yeah, during the hard times.
Who owns Harley now, then?
It's a publicly held company. I think it's independent.
Okay.
You know what? Let me not say that. I don't know if it is or not. I want to say, I just remembered, almost remembered a company that did own it. Its stock is still, you can buy Harley stock. That doesn't necessarily mean that company is a totally owned subsidiary. It just means that they allow, it could be that 70% of the stock is owned by some big company. And so I don't guess I really know. So whatever I've said, forget it.
Tankinator's just put in that Harley was purchased by Voith in the 70s.
Did you say Voight?
Yeah, V-O-I-T-H. He's just said, take that back.
I should know. I worked right across the street from the headquarters in Milwaukee for for a couple of years, but I don't know.
Well, I don't ride anymore. I haven't ridden in many, many years, and it's probably best.
Yeah, I haven't ridden for over 10 years now, and I've just been told by my doctor I might have arthritis in my hip. So it looks like my riding days are completely over.
Oh, I've got arthritis almost everywhere, but I think I could ride if I wanted to. I just don't think it's a good idea anymore. Here about, I don't know, I guess 10 years ago, my wife offered to let me go test drive we were driving by a shop that sold Triumphs, and I'm longingly looking at the new things, and I ended up stopping and looking, and they had, besides the new bikes, they had a bunch of old bikes from the 60s and 70s that they had. Some of them were just junkers and parts bikes, and some of them were had been totally restored. And I just, oh man. And she said, well, you want to test drive it? And I'm going, and the owner of the store was, or the, yeah, I don't know if it's the owner, but you know, the person that working in the store saying, yeah, go ahead. You get a license? I said, yeah. I said, take it, whichever one you want. Drive them all. I'm going, oh man, this would be so much fun, but I didn't. Because they are innately dangerous.
Yeah, can't remember the number of times I've come off a bike.
Yeah, my biker friend said that there are two kinds of bike riders, bikers who've gone down and bikers who will go down.
No, there's three. There's those that deny they've ever been down, and they're called liars.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember one time I was saying, I wonder how far I can lean this bike on a. I gotten caught in the rain, and I said, I just wonder how far I can lean this thing on this wet road. And I mean, like 2 seconds later, I'm on the road. The bike is on its side, sliding down the road, and I'm still holding on to the handlebars, being dragged down the road. And I'm going, oh, okay, you can't lean this thing.
I remember the first bike I had was a little Honda Cub 90, supposed to be classed as a scooter now, but I remember sliding that, and it went across the other side of the road and hit a car, and I got it fixed for the equivalent of about $60-$70 your money, and I think it cost about $300-$400 to fix the car.
Radio check over.
Hi, Tank.
Glad y'all can hear me. AMF bought Harley in the late 60s, I guess, and sold out to a bunch of investors in the early 80s.
Thanks. Are you a rider yourself or ex-rider?
No, won't catch me on those death machines, but I live pretty close to the New York, Pennsylvania plant.
Ah.
I wish I had been an early investor after the most recent bankruptcy of Harley, because I think that stock has probably gone up many times since then.
Be a good time to sell it, frankly.
Well, I probably would have sold it this last year at some point.
Yeah, first off, how many $30,000 motorcycles can the world buy, you know?
Yeah. They're a bit of a Rolls Royce in this country as well. You pay about $30 just to get a T-shirt.
And second of all, is they're really abusing their workers. They're threatening to move plants offshore, which is bizarre considering their primary draw is that they're American made.
Yeah, but wouldn't that mean under Trump's latest trade things that they'd end up costing twice as much?
Oh, probably only 25% extra. You wouldn't mind that, would you?
You know, what's funny about that is we've got the tariffs that really haven't gone into effect yet. And, like, Ford and Chevy are trying to blame their woes on that, which, again, they haven't gone into effect yet. Toyota, Nissan, BMW all have plants in the United States. They haven't had to raise their rates.
Yeah, I've been saying that probably the effect that will be that it'll drive places offshore under the guise of running from the tariffs, and then the tariffs certainly won't amount to much at all, but that'll be the result.
I think Ford was already in trouble. I think if they hadn't already announced that they were going to stop making cars, they had already figured it out, that they were going to pretty much just stick with trucks and vans and Mustangs.
That's the most short-sighted decision I can imagine.
Yeah, I didn't like seeing them do it. I've been a Ford stockholder for many years, but I like the dividends, although right now I'm way in the hole on the stock price.
That decision doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, do they think the truck market's going to last forever?
Well, if you lived in my neighborhood where 80% of the vehicles that drive by are pickup trucks and most of those are Fords, yeah, that's what they think.
So are they running a big electrification of those things, or are they still in the dark ages of internal combustion engine?
Oh, no, Ford doesn't have any electric vehicles, as I'm aware of.
Yeah, I don't know about them doing any electrical stuff either, although it would be a good idea. I know a guy's got a Tesla, and he really loves it. He's had it for several years, and it kind of makes sense. I'm thinking if I had a major motor problem with my car, I might consider doing a conversion. I'd like to have an electric car.
I take that back. I remember seeing something about Rangers, the limited rental thing back in the late 90s where they converted Ranger pickup trucks to all electric, but they were all rentals. So there aren't, they took them all back and destroyed them.
I wonder if it's easier or quicker now to change tooling, and so they're thinking if they need to switch, then they'll switch later. That's what I'm wondering, if that's getting bigger and faster, like software development.
Yeah, it's going to need some big manufacturer in America though to actually grasp the bullet and turn over to making mass-produced electric vehicles to make them popular over there, I suppose. Because at the moment, they're really a premium in price, aren't they?
They're a premium, and they're also inconvenient with the lack of infrastructure and the long charge times. I mean, even if they've got the hyper-speed thing that the Teslas do, it's still a lot longer than it takes to fill up a tank.
Oh, yeah.
That Chevy with their Volt, they didn't push that as hard as they should have. That's the best of both worlds, really. It's an electric or gas electric. So basically, the motor just charges the battery essentially, which is great. Great vehicle.
BMW has a car like that that's got a little 1.5 liter 3-cylinder engine that you can, it's got a plug-in electric, and you don't have to ever run the engine, but if you are going a long distance, you can fire up the little motor and keep it charged, and going up a hill, it's got plenty of juice to get over the hill, and going level, probably that 3-liter, that 1.5-liter engine is probably enough to just cruise at, 70 miles an hour, and continue to charge the engine a little bit, the battery a little bit. So, that would be great for long distance, but, a pretty good percentage of the people in this country, at least, where we have very little public transportation, have two cars per family or more. And so if one of them could be electric, and for the last 30 years, my wife and I have had two cars. And for 28 of those, I've been within 4 miles of where I worked. An electric car would have been fine. And when we went on a trip, we'd always take her car. And so my car is very low mileage, and the two cars I've had over the last those years were very low mileage, and she wore the cars out because she drove further to work. But even now, she drives probably 22 miles each way, so less than 50 miles a day. So she could do electric too, even for her job. And, you know, like I say, if there's one, and then you rent a car on the, if you want to go on a trip on the weekend, you go rent one with, that takes gasoline.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the start of the way forward, is just for local journeys that people have electric. And like you say, they rent something that will do longer journeys. But eventually the technology will catch up and you'll get electric vehicles that can do 500 miles on a charge and then and can charge up in less than an hour.
Well, I think the battery swap is probably the way it'll go. You won't really charge your battery. But I don't think we should be too worried or too afraid of the current cost. It wasn't very long ago that the TV that's $400 at Walmart, the same size was $16,000. So I don't let the early adopter price scare me too much.
Yeah, I agree. I was about to say that I think the battery swap is kind of the way to go for at least in a limited way. And how, I don't know how you do that. You might have to do it in a like a you're a member of a AAA club or something, and that gives you the ability to swap your battery out. They'd have to have some. The engineering would have to be based around the 2-minute battery swap, but which obviously is not now. But yeah, that would be something that make a lot of sense.
You also still need to
standardize.
Go on.
Yeah, I think they'll standardize, and then you'll just swap them out like you do gas tanks for the things you use in your barbecue grill. I'm pretty sure that's whatever we use for power, if it's not some kind of an instantaneous charge thing, I think that's where to go.
Yeah, but it's the infrastructure and having all those swappable batteries in the place where you need them, isn't it, that's going to be the issue?
Well, it'll be along major thoroughfares if they do batteries. They're also looking at capacitors, which would charge super fast, and that's another possibility, is that there's no battery. It's a battery capacitor thing, and if they come up with a way to have some type of a device that will charge really fast and get you 200 miles down the road, then that would probably be preferable. But then, of course, then there's infrastructure that would have to be built. But it would
not only infrastructure with that would be extremely dangerous in a lot of cases in an accident. Imagine dumping several kilowatts of energy out at once.
Man, would that be fun to watch?
Exactly.
From a safe distance.
And capacitors can dump that kind of energy quick. I know they don't hold that much power for space, but yeah, caps are really interesting tech, but they're dangerous.
But yeah, I understand they are working on it, though.
I think that the safety issue is one of the engineering problems that they're trying to work out.
Well, also, has anybody ever thought about simple charging trailers for long range use?
I never thought of that. That's a great idea.
What do you mean you would haul a trailer to charge with? I'm sure I'm following.
You just have a jumper from the trailer that you're towing to have more battery.
Yeah, just a small trailer that's got about 500 miles worth of battery in it. That'd be great. That makes a lot of sense. You just go, you rent that. You go and pick that up over at Hertz Rent-A-Battery and just plug it into your car and off you go.
What if it had a 5-kilowatt generator on it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's just dirty.
But yeah, then you're back to gas guzzling, aren't you?
Well, I mean, high amount of energy and small amount of space. I mean, frankly,
actually, there's a couple of problems with battery power. One is your battery efficiency is temperature sensitive. In cold temperatures, your capacity is much lower than it is in warm temperatures, which is a problem for those of us in northernish climates or who have northernish weather. I'm saying northernish weather because at the moment everything north of Atlanta is having a winter like New England.
Yeah, there's lots of different issues at the moment that they've still not taken on board or thought about, but, you know, give it another 20 years and a lot of these kinks will have been ironed out.
Also, the difference between gasoline power for charging, which can be a very highly tuned system, much higher tuned than it can be when it has to be used as primary power.
That's what I was talking about earlier with the electric or gas electric systems. Much more efficient. They've been using them in ships, and they've been using them in locomotives for years and years and years. You can tune a motor to have a very tight power band and not have to run it outside that power band, and it can be tuned to much higher efficiencies than your standard vehicle engine.
Yeah, it also doesn't have to run that well at lower RPM and higher RPM, which means you don't have to have all the fancy, my car is, you know,
camshafts.
Yeah, it changes the timing is changed instantly, continuously. The valve timing is adjusted, you know, 1,000 times a minute, and none of that stuff would be necessary if you had an engine that only runs at 3,500 RPM, or if it's diesel, you know, something 1,500 RPM or whatever, whatever they run at, I don't know. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It would surprise me if the temperature thing hasn't already been solved. Or do people not buy Teslas that live up north?
They buy Subarus up north.
Yeah, I don't think they're gonna really want to have a Tesla where there's a lot of snow and there's a lot of potential for uncleared roads.
But is that because of the battery or because of the traction?
Both. We've got a 08 Ford Escape hybrid, and it runs a heater on the battery. Subsequent models, they eliminated the hybrid models because they could achieve the equivalent fuel economy that the hybrid got on a V6. But tech-wise, it works well enough, but it's nothing to write home about. It's just an ordinary car, really. I often wondered why they never really came up with more tech, like Stirling motors on the exhausts and that sort of thing.
Well, I like my car, but it's very technical, and I don't know if I, you know, it costs a lot of money to keep it running, probably. And I would go electric, and something electric with a small motor to fire up when necessary wouldn't be a bad thing.
That'd be the Chevy Volt.
I'd go electric, but the economics of getting rid of my current car and moving over to an electric one just don't add up, because I do very, very small mileage these days, and the amount of money I'd lose on the old vehicle and then having to buy a new electric vehicle, it just doesn't work out.
So the internet, it's about 40 to 50% battery efficiency loss, capacity loss in Chicago. So there you go. I guess it matters a lot.
That's why we don't get good efficiency in the UK, because it's never warm enough.
You guys have a warmer climate than Chicago does.
Yeah, just a bit of a joke, that.
Yeah, if you look in the Stirling engines, they're really interesting. They run off of heat and air.
Again, no good in the cold, I guess.
No, they're fine in the cold. They run off of they're an external combustion engine, essentially. But you can run them off of the small toy ones that you can make in, you know, your workshop or whatever, that'll run off the heat in your hand. The differential between the ambient temperature and your hand's temperature.
Guys, I'm going to go because my leg's starting to play me up. So sitting in front of the computer is not doing me any favors at the moment. So it's been nice talking to you.
Take care. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Hope you're feeling better soon, and maybe after a bit of a break, we'll see you again.
I'll definitely join the chat again at some stage, but it's coming up to 10 o'clock at night in the UK here, so it'll probably be tomorrow before they close the stream down.
Well, it's been nice to meet you. Take care. Happy New Year.
Yeah, same back. It's been nice to meet you guys, and have a great time.
I'll step away as well. Talk to you all later.
Yeah, this looks like a good time to take a break. Maybe I will too.
I kind of jumped in there while you guys were talking. Hello.
Hello.
I'm not sure who was from the UK, but you're talking about short trips, but that seems like the perfect thing for what some of these electric or hybrid cars are designed for.
Yeah, I was saying earlier how that would have been fine for my household, where we've got two automobiles at all times, and I work 4 miles from home and rarely probably drove more than 25 miles. It'd be unusual to go over 25 miles and really unusual to go over 50 miles in a day.
Well, I live right next to a dry cleaning establishment, and the amount of waste energy that comes off of that place is amazing.
A lot of businesses are, you know, capturing that sort of thing, either the heat or waste or something, but not a local dry cleaner. It costs too much money for the technology.
Well, I'm just remembering when I was at a condo complex, and they were using heat pumps, and sometimes if I recall correctly, the temperature of the working fluid was only like 70 degrees.
That doesn't sound warm enough. You're talking about the refrigerant used to heat the space?
That's what struck in my mind, although I don't know what scale they were using.
Ah, okay, I'm sorry. My brain only works Fahrenheit, so it's possible that would be just fine in centigrade.
I was assuming a Fahrenheit scale. I knew that one of the things that this place did is it converted from electric boilers, talk about a way to burn money, to city gas.
If you think about it, think about how electric cars work. You know how you take your foot off the gas as it slows down, or you take your foot off the accelerator, it slows down, and it the motor then acts as a generator and recharges the battery so you don't lose any of it. If you were to take that idea and put it into more things, and I'm sure other factories and stuff are using similar ideas to capture what has been in the past waste energy, you know, that'll go a long ways. And I'm sure they're doing that in a lot of places.
Well, how much heat is being dumped by air conditioning units in large structures?
Well, if a building is dumping heat from the coolers and making heat somewhere else, that's something that can be fixed. And you might also connect something on it that would take that heat and turn it into electricity, I suppose. But usually where you've got something as waste, it's because you actually need it. But yeah, when you mention the cooling, especially like a place like here in Houston, where we air condition for pretty much the whole year, there's always a lot of waste heat produced. A lot of that could be turned into, you know, something useful.
As you mentioned, the technology for that is too expensive. It'd be great to start seeing that streamlined.
Yeah, there. The place I worked retroed their air conditioning systems I'm not sure how long ago, somewhere probably around 15 years ago, maybe not quite that long, where they put a system in because the electricity is cheaper at night, because everybody needs electricity during the daytime when it's hot. They run their air conditioners. So we would make cold water at night. We'd run refrigeration unit, and we would chill this million-gallon tank of water to just above freezing. And then during the day, when it was hot, you take that cold water and run it through coils and blow air across it, and that's how you cool the building. But there's no refrigeration machines are running during the daytime when the electric rates go up. So at a certain hour, no electricity is running to power a compressor. So all it's doing is running water pumps and fans, which are use a lot less electricity. And it's more efficient, and we got a kickback from the electric company because that kept them from having to put in more capacity for power, and we got a kickback from the government for doing something, you know, good for the environment or others. So we end up getting a significant part of the cost of the system kicked back from the government and from the electric company.
I have noticed it does seem like industrial places tend to use water chillers a whole lot more often. Here in El Paso, we don't have to use quite the we don't have to chill the water at night. We can just evaporate it, and that usually works pretty well for most air conditioners and other cooling systems on the commercial or industrial level.
Y'all use evaporative cooling on industrial type of buildings?
A lot of times you'll see outdoor water chillers, which are essentially giant evaporative coolers. They might do a little bit more cooling after that, but for the bulk of the heat removal, will be on some sort of evaporative-like chiller.
That's great. I know, well, I used to have friends in Odessa, and pretty much every house had evaporative cooler. There's very little refrigeration type air conditioners in Odessa, it seemed like, at least back a few years back.
Yeah, it's changed a little on the residential level. A lot of people like to have the refrigeration because some of those months it does get a little humid. I think around late June, early July, and then also the refrigeration does get a little bit cooler, but on the, you know, on the industrial level, definitely.
Yeah, I know they use the coolers, but the often those a chiller is associated with other types of equipment that have waste heat, so that's not necessarily cooling the building. I've worked in hospitals where they had big chillers, but they didn't have anything to do with the air conditioning system. They were used for cooling other types of equipment.
Well, that is true. There is a lot of stuff that does that, but I have seen, like, at the local library, I saw where they actually had the water lines running into, like you said, coils for the venting system.
Well, I think it's a great idea in a place where the humidity is low enough for the swamp coolers to work. I wouldn't mind paying less for cooling my house, but you can't do that here because the humidity is too high most of the year.
When does it drop below 100% humidity over there?
Oh, come on, it's not that bad. Well, it is today.
So, one of the interesting microcomputer projects that I ran across was somebody in Vermont had added atmospheric cooling to his freezer system.
That's not a terrible idea if it's a place where, you know, a couple of months out of the year you can it's actually cold enough.
Well, I suspect that there's a large chunk of the northern United States that could save gobs of money from similar systems. My brother was a long-haul trucker, and he was going through one of the northern states, I forget which one, and he said he looked back, he was hauling a refrigerated trailer. Standard refrigerated temperature for solid frozen items is 20 below zero Fahrenheit. Well, this refrigeration system was saying that it was running the heater to keep things at 20 below.
Yeah, I have a brother-in-law that lives in Alaska. I suspect he's got an entirely different set of problems than we have down here. Oh, like an earthquake a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I used to have the earthquake widget in XFCE running, and you'd have a constant stream of little quakes and quite frequent six.
Hey, Paul. Hey, Netminer. Hey, Honky.
Hey, Joe.
Good to see you on here. We were going to come try and hang out with you this evening after supper with Jackie's family, since this is probably our last day in town.
Well, yeah, I'll try to make sure I'm gonna have it.
But since we're driving tomorrow, we're not going to do that whole New Year's thing.
Yeah.
Jackie says hi.
Hi, tell her hi.
Hi.
He says hi back. Oh, is Chris going to jump on?
I don't know, but I was interested to hear, I'm sorry, I didn't see who it was, finish talking about the earthquakes and refrigeration systems.
Yeah, I had the earthquake widget on XFCE, and every little while I'd get a alert box that would say that there's been a Richter 6 earthquake at a certain location. They're pretty frequent, a couple of times a day, I think.
Yeah, you definitely want to have some sort of refrigerant or halo detection system, and that you don't want to suffocate yourself if you have earthquakes going on that could rupture the pipes.
So how's that 7130 treating you, Paul?
I haven't played too much more with it. We almost ended up using it to do the live stream for D&D the other day, but then... Sorry about that. Finally got the computer that was supposed to be doing it working again, so... But I haven't gotten the Wi-Fi working on it yet, and the card that I ordered...
Right. Did you?
Yeah, I ordered a card, but I just found out that it's not supposed to be here until February.
Ouch. That's horrible. Order a different one.
I should. I think I only paid like $17 for it, so it's not that expensive.
Well... The link I sent you was one for $12, and it should have been kind of quick.
The only problem with that one is it was not an M.2 like the other one is. It's a
It was one of the ones that was listed on that webpage I sent you. That's why I sent you the link on it.
It was, but it wasn't the M.2, and so I was looking for an M.2 one.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind if I end up ordering one.
It looks
like the processor is faster and it has the same amount of RAM as the 102HA that I have.
Yeah, so far it performs very well. The only Wi-Fi device that I've been able to get working on it, though, around here has been my phone. I plugged my phone into it and I've gotten Wi-Fi or data... whichever way on that, and you know, I've been doing stuff with that, but I also have a problem with the on-screen keyboard doesn't auto-populate when I open up Chrome or Firefox, and I can't figure out how to get it to force it.
What I did was I added a quick launch key in the taskbar specifically for just the on-screen keyboard, so I could pop it up real quick and drop it down real quick. And that was also how I implemented right clicks on a couple of the devices that didn't have it built in.
All right, yeah. The Mint, and I'll check that out. I'll probably end up doing that. I was going to ask you about it, but you got to it first. On Mint, though, it just has a long press the primary key, and it will initiate the secondary key.
And that works in some applications. I know it works really well in Chrome. But sometimes on the desktop itself, that hasn't been working for me. And so the keyboard, if you adjust the keyboard a bit on the styles, you can get this one that gives you all the different clicks that you can do with a mouse, a double click, a right click, a center click, and click on that first and then push wherever you want the right click or the center click.
Yeah, the way that the Android app for VNC that I have works is pretty intuitive with all of that, and I wish that Mint would do it something like that, where, yeah, you can zoom with it. You actually, the way that Ubuntu does it also works, too.
Well, you can install Ubuntu if you want. I'm just a Mint fan.
Well, I mean, I like Mint, and the added benefit is that it did have more of the drivers necessary for things, and that's probably why the tilting worked just straight out of the box with that.
Right.
But I do like how if you tap two fingers with that one, it will do the right key. And then, you can also zoom, and if you scroll with... You don't scroll with one finger, but you can scroll with two fingers.
Right. No, see, some of the devices do have the two-finger scrolling, but I'll start the two-finger scrolling, and I guess I either move my fingers close together or farther apart as I start scrolling, and so then it'll turn into a zoom function instead of a scroll function.
Don't have fat fingers.
Can't help it.
Yeah, I can't either.
So how was gaming the other night?
Well, we started a little bit late because the owner of the store took off with the with some of the things that we needed, but we were able to eventually get the cameras going and plug everything back to where it go and got all the updates on the computer running and were able to do it again. And it was riveting, as David's been really good at doing lately.
Have you guys had some audio improvements? I know last time I tried to watch, it was a little rough.
Unfortunately, no. I don't know if you were listening when we had the wireless lapel mics or when we were using the table mic. Both have been bad. We're currently using the table mic because people said it's easier to understand people, though it personally hurts my ears more.
Oh, you should. I know that around here, the snowball mic, there's somebody that was selling one. Thank you. On Facebook Marketplace for like $30. I know I showed you the link. It was still up last time I looked, but for all around the table, it's actually pretty good.
Okay, you know what? I'll check that out.
That's what I'm using right now.
Oh, nice. I should probably get something like that. I'm pretty sure if I showed up with some equipment that everyone else will be happy to give it a try. He was currently looking at a rather expensive $130, $150 shotgun microphone that required us to get another at least $70 soundboard with phantom power in it just to use it. And I'm like, Kent, isn't there another tier that we can go to before we go to pro level?
Yeah. Well, this one, it's not really, it is supposed to be directional, but it doesn't do directional all that well. So it will work for a whole table. And I know you heard the dogs a little while ago, and they're off in another room. So.
That has been one of our biggest problems as well, is that there's an SCA group that goes on right outside that the store owner has pretty much said that if it's the choice between us or them, that it's going to be us leaving. So, you know, we don't want to.
Right. This mic would be a table.
Yeah, and the idea is actually to get a couple of those not very directional mics like that, like one per side of the table, and use those to try and improve the quality sound. We're not so concerned of the sound of the dice rolling on the table because we kind of think that's part of the aesthetic of things. But you know, reducing the other background noise would be great. And making us in general sound not like we're pieces of paper.
Yeah, that first cast that you all did, that really sounded bad.
Yeah, and we know that we do have a few people who are actually following us, so we need to start upping up the game on our audio. That's the first step. The cameras is the second step, because we know that is important, but not nearly as important as people being able to hear us.
Huh. Well,
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.